while 247 Leopard 2A4 main battle tanks in the Polish arsenal. Denisov was also known to be one of the principal architects of the new generation warfare strategy, and a personal favorite of the Russian president. The GRU was by far the largest and most effective Russian intelligence service in both field agents and combat operatives, dwarfing the more famous FSB and SVR agencies, with which they competed for resources and political favor. Colonel Maximovich wasn't sure why a man of Denisov's stature had been invited at the last minute to observe this relatively minor exercise. It only added to the Serbian's anxiety. "Your men are well trained in CQC," Denisov said. "You should be pleased." "Colonel Smolov deserves most of the credit, sir," the Serbian replied. "It's his training regimen we follow." "Nonsense. These are your men, and they obey your orders," Smolov insisted. "Thank you, sir. They're good men. It's an honor to lead them." Today's exercise was intended to take down an unnamed parliamentary building, but everybody in the observation post knew exactly what that meant. The practice facility had been re-engineered to fit exact blueprints of the actual target building just across the border. Denisov turned to the Serbian commander, the disastrous report from Croatia and the empty cargo ship still on his mind. "How soon could you mobilize the rest of your battalion, Colonel?" The tall Serbian grinned. 24 hours maximum, sir." Smolov frowned, curious. No such mobilization had been scheduled. "An impromptu training exercise for the Serbians, Colonel." Denisov smiled. "What else would it be?" Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Jack hardly noticed the stink of the garbage chute outside his door as he entered his apartment. He kicked off his shoes in the foyer and fell onto the living room couch with a yawn and a sigh. It wasn't as if he'd been humping a 50-pound ruck up the side of Mount Rainier or doing wind sprints at the beach on Coronado Island. But a long day of cab rides, failed phone calls, and often tense, suspicious encounters left him emotionally spent. He'd run through the entire second list of 23 names that Gavin had sent him. Three were no longer in country, and the two he left messages for hadn't called him back yet. Nor did he expect them to. Now what? He could give overworked Gavin another call and ask him to generate yet another list, but he doubted the IT whiz had any more AIDA cards up his digital sleeve. Besides, Gavin had actual work to do as the man in charge of all things computer-related for both Hendley Associates and the campus. His other option was to cancel his flight back home and keep hunting for other clues in the public record, or just keep his fingers crossed and hope the emigres came back home or the ones he left messages for would call back. The only problem with that was the text Jerry had sent an hour ago. "Glad you're coming home tomorrow. A lot going on. Need you back ASAP." So with his two lists exhausted, no prospects for a third, and his boss breathing down his neck, it was clear to Jack it was time to get packed and head for the airport tomorrow. He'd tried, hadn't he? Sure, his mother would be deeply disappointed. Not that she'd ever say anything. In fact, she'd tell him how grateful she was that he'd tried his best. And failed. The "and failed" was the snarling demon inside Jack's head. He couldn't stand the thought of failing at anything. What would cut him the deepest was the hidden disappointment his mother would undoubtedly feel when he told her the bad news that he couldn't find little AIDA. His mother never asked him to do anything for her. She was the most self-reliant person he'd ever known. As a physician, she was always doing something for others, sometimes risking her health and even her life to save people's eyesight. The idea of letting her down was almost too much to bear. But he didn't really have a choice. Staying here another couple days or even another couple years wouldn't change the likely outcome. AIDA Kuric, his mother's young patient from so many years ago, simply didn't exist. And he had important campus work to do, as well as his work as a financial analyst at Hendley Associates. He was a good worker and a good soldier. But he was also his mother's son. He was so lost in his thoughts that he actually jumped when he heard a knock at the door. He was expecting his landlords to drop by for an inspection before he flew out tomorrow. Jack padded over to the door in his stocking feet and opened it. Oh, not his landlords. Chapter 34. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Jack's jaw dropped, just like in the cartoons. Standing in front of him was one of the most beautiful women he'd ever seen. And maybe one of the angriest. Jack didn't care. Her thick, chestnut, shoulder-length hair and full-figured beach body would have caught his attention any day of the week. But her startling blue eyes absolutely gobsmacked him. She must have liked what she saw, too, because the harshness in those magnificent eyes softened. She might even have blushed a little. God knows he felt the jolt racing through him, from the nape of his neck all the way down to his toes. Standing behind her in the tiled hallway was a slope-shouldered slab of meat, with a shaved head and a closely trimmed beard, staring daggers at him. The woman gathered her wits. Her softness disappeared. All business now. "You are Jack Ryan. If you're looking for me, yeah. I mean, hell yeah." "Yes, I'm Jack Ryan," he said evenly.
"My name is Aida Kuric. I understand you were looking for me."
"Yes, I was. I mean, I am." In a million years, Jack never would have connected her grainy driver's license photo, which Gavin had sent him, to that perfect face.
"Please come in."
"No, thank you. What is it that you want from me?"
"Nothing, I promise. I was trying to find you in order to give you something."
"A letter?"
"Yes."
"From whom?"
Good English, Jack thought.
"My mother."
"Why would your mother want to give a letter to me, a perfect stranger?"
Mr. Clean shifted his stance, his glowering eyes still fixed on Jack. From where Jack stood, he couldn't see a weapon on the man, unless you counted the 2 17-inch guns hanging from his wide shoulders. "You and my mother may have met many years ago when you were a child. She's an ophthalmologist. I mean, an eye surgeon."
"Yes, of course. Go on."
"She performed an eye surgery 26 years ago on a little girl named Aida Kuric who was injured in the Bosnian War and saved her eye. She knew I was coming to the region and asked me to see if I could find Aida and give her a letter she wrote to her."
"How do you know I was the little girl?"
"I don't. That's why I was asking all over town and looking for every Aida Kuric I could find. But you'd know. I'm sure you'd remember something like that." Aida's eyes narrowed.
"Let's say that I do remember. What does she want from me?"
"Nothing, I promise. She never forgot you and just wanted you to know that. I haven't read the letter, but that's what she told me. Can I get it for you?" Jack watched the wheels turn behind her eyes. She offered a slight smile. Finally,
"Yes, of course."
"Won't you come in?" Jack glanced over her shoulder. "Your friend, too."
"All right."
She whispered something to Mr. Clean in Bosanski. He nodded and stepped back into the hallway, facing the stairwell, folding his hands in front of him as Aida shut the door. Aida didn't budge from the little foyer. She saw the look on Jack's face.
"My friend is concerned. It's a difficult time these days for Bosniaks like me. You understand the politics of my country? The history?"
"A little. More than most Americans, I suppose. Thanks to Rojko Struna's mini-lecture on the drive from the Ljubljana airport," Jack reminded himself.
"Can I get you anything?"
Aida shook her head.
"No, thank you. It's late."
"Then let me get that letter." Jack dashed to the bedroom and pulled his mother's letter from a suitcase pocket.
He hurried back, suddenly aware of his socks as he slid a little on the polished tile floor. He glanced down at his feet and wiggled his toes. Aida stifled a giggle. Jack handed her the blank envelope. His mother was clever enough not to use official White House stationery. She wasn't trying to impress Aida, just communicate with her. Aida slipped an unadorned fingernail beneath the sealed flap and opened it. She pulled the folded letter out but didn't open it. She glanced up at Jack and then back down to the letter. Jack saw in her eyes the tug of war between suspicion and curiosity. Curiosity finally won out. She opened the letter carefully, as if it were an ancient manuscript. Her eyes swept back and forth as she read, her frown softening into a little smile. As she reached the end, she touched one hand to her mouth, her eyes misting.
"You said you haven't read this?"
"No."
"It's quite beautiful."
She brushed a fingertip against the corner of one of her almond-shaped eyes.
"May I keep this?"
Jack smiled.
"Of course.
It's yours."
"Thank you. And please, thank your mother for me. It was very kind and very thoughtful of her."
"If you'd like to tell her yourself, you can reach her here." Jack handed Aida a plain business card with his mother's P.O. box address. She took it. No wedding ring, Jack noticed.
"Thank you. I would like that very much.
Are you sure you don't want a drink or something?"
"I have to get back, but thank you.
And thank you for taking the time to find me and for delivering this." Jack shrugged.
"It was no big deal." "When do you go back to the States?"
"Tomorrow, actually." Aida's shoulders slumped.
"Oh, that's too bad. I would have liked to show you my city."
"Well, it's not a problem to change my plans."
"Really? That would be wonderful. Can you come back to the tour office at 10 o'clock tomorrow?"
"Sure. That would be great."
"Wonderful."
She put her hand out. Jack shook it, a firm grip. Their hands lingered for a moment longer than he expected. More electricity.
"See you tomorrow, then."
She turned and opened the door, whispered something to her man as the two of them disappeared down the stairwell. Jack shut the door. What was he going to tell Cherry? He'd promised his boss he was flying home tomorrow. But that sure as hell wasn't going to happen now. Chapter 35. At 10 o'clock the next morning, Ambassador Topal sat at the head of the table in the conference room of the Islamic Peace Studies Center, IPSC, built with funds from a religious organization based in Ankara, Turkey. Lining both sides of the conference table sat several Bosniak Islamic religious and community leaders. Two of them were bearded imams from conservative mosques in the suburbs. All of the others were decidedly moderate in their views, including two women, one in a silky blue and yellow headscarf, and the other one, the IPSC director, wearing no head covering at all. Topal had called this morning's brief meeting. Recent polls showed the upcoming unity referendum was plummeting in the polls because of the recent ethnic violence. Without a strong Bosniak voter turnout in favor of the referendum, it was doomed to fail. The purpose of today's meeting was to shore up the support of those assembled and of their respective constituencies before attending his next event. There was one empty chair at the table that concerned the ambassador. He would look into that later. "We feel that we have a religious duty to show the world we can live in peace with Catholics and Orthodox, as well as Jews and people of every faith, or no faith at all," the director said. "The unity referendum is vital to the exercise of that sacred duty." Several heads nodded around the table. Topal radiated a grandfatherly smile. "I applaud your ecumenicism, Madam Director." One of the imams spoke up. We cannot allow the unity referendum to become a mutual suicide pact.
No, of course not, Topal said. My government would be the first one to oppose it if I thought that Muslim interests were in any way compromised.
The imam placed an open palm against his chest.
Of this, we have no doubt.
Thank you, Topal said. The man's mosque was one of hundreds destroyed in the war by Serb and Croat forces, and one of the many rebuilt with money from Ankara. Topal had personally approved this imam's reconstruction project.
The headmaster of the largest private Islamic primary school, another facility built with Turkish funds, spoke up.
The government must redouble its efforts to stop the anti-Muslim violence we've been reading about.
Topal nodded again.
I have received assurances that everything is being done to monitor the situation. But my sources also tell me the violence has been directed against other communities. Small acts of retribution.
Big fires begin with small sparks, the other imam said. His mosque had been rebuilt with Saudi money.
Which is why we must always take precautions and remain vigilant, even as we work for peace, Topal said.
Moreheads nodded.
Turkey is the hope of all Muslim nations, and President Usyakup is the father of the Ummah, the first imam said. We are not afraid to work for peace because we know you are not afraid to fight for us.
The Turkish president also said that every mosque was a barracks in his radical youth, Topal reminded himself.
Usyakup had gone to great lengths in recent years to position Turkey as the new caliphate for the Muslim world. He was engineering an Ottoman Empire revival, including the restoration of historic Ottoman symbols, artwork, and buildings in Turkey and throughout the region.
Usyakup even brought back Ottoman-styled uniforms to the presidential palace guard. State maps were being subtly republished to include areas formerly under Ottoman rule, and Turkish military and economic aid were spreading across the Middle East, and even to Muslim Africa.
Let us pray it never comes to that, Topal said. Peace is always better than war, and peace is the way of the true Muslim. But as the Prophet said, peace be upon him. He is a true believer who protects his brother or sister, both present and absent.
The two imams began applauding, and the others quickly joined in. Topal smiled, crinkling his owlish eyes, seemingly embarrassed by the display, waving his hand to quell the collective enthusiasm. Inwardly, he was shouting with joy.
The clapping stopped as he stood. Please forgive me, but I have another engagement to prepare for. I urge you all to do your utmost to encourage your people to vote for the referendum, and for them to encourage their neighbors to do so as well. The future of all Bosnia and of Bosniaks depends upon it. If the referendum fails, then Bosnia fails. And who knows what will happen after that?
You can count on us, the director said. And with that, the meeting ended.
Jack arrived at the Happy Times office at exactly 10 a.m. Emir stood behind the desk, greeting Jack with a forced smile.
Welcome back, Mr. Ryan.
Is Aida here?
She will be with you shortly. Can I get you a bottle of water or something else?
No, thanks. I'm good.
Jack had skipped his standard morning pita chocolate bomb breakfast and opted for a plate of fried eggs, pork sausage and fresh fruit, and a couple cups of dark Bosnian coffee. The office door behind the desk opened, and Aida appeared. Jack almost forgot how beautiful she was, despite having spent half the night thinking about her. In tight jeans and a fitted but modest blouse, her figure was even more pronounced. Their eyes locked for a moment, and they both smiled.
Emir caught this. We should get going, he said, stepping out from behind the desk.
No need. I'll take him myself, Aida said, still staring at Jack.
Emir's constant smile faded.
But it might be better if I'm with you.
I think Jack can take care of us both, she said. She turned to Emir. Don't you have the 10:30 tour? I called Ibrahim. He said he can take it.
Ibrahim needs a break.
Her voice lowered.
You keep it.
Emir tensed. Aida approached him. Emir's head lowered, like a dog bowing before its master.
They asked for you specifically.
Aida lifted his chin with her finger. He gazed up into her eyes.
You're the best, and they know it.
And so do I. Emir smiled and nodded. I need to fuel the van. He turned to Jack, the smile still plastered on his face, but his dark eyes betrayed him.
Enjoy your tour, Mr. Ryan.
Jack returned the menacing stare with a grin. Oh, I will. Trust me. Emir pushed through the glass door with its tinkling bell without responding.
Ready to take a little walk? Aida asked.
Jack smiled.
Sounds good.
The GRU officer with the hazel eyes heard the coded ding on her laptop, signaling an encrypted email from her superiors at Hodinka. The subject line read, Re-identification, subject number 102459-BIH. She opened the file, along with the attached video clip of Kolak and the mystery man her facial recognition software couldn't ID 2 days prior. Her eyes skipped the preliminaries and found what she needed most. Subject identity, Jack Ryan Jr. GRU status, person of interest. She was reading the details when her partner appeared over her shoulder, his cheap cologne more pungent than usual.
Anything interesting?
She turned to him with a smile. Her instincts had paid off.
Very.
He noticed her eyes had turned pale green.
Tell me more.
Chapter 36. Jack and Aida crossed the busy street and entered back into the old town.
Where is your bodyguard?
Ibrahim is not really a bodyguard. He's just tough-looking. He's actually quite gentle, unless you provoke him.
I'll do my best not to.
I only brought him with me last night because I didn't know who you were. My work is controversial, so I took a precaution.
How is the tour business controversial?
I run a refugee aid organization. It's not exactly popular.
I assumed you owned the tour company.
At least, that's what Gavin's notes indicated.
I do own it. Emir runs the daily operations, but it's mine. He's also my number one tour guide, but I have many others.
Owning your own business is difficult, I imagine.
It is. But I'm not afraid of hard work. Besides, it gives me financial independence.
She shot him a sly glance. No need to rely on a man to put a roof over my head.
When did you start the company?
I didn't. The company was my father's. I was studying to become a medical doctor when he died, so I inherited it.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you. He was a good man. Tell me about your refugee center.
We just opened it last year. In a poor country like Bosnia, people resent refugees taking up scarce resources, even Muslim refugees.
Why? Bosnia is Muslim majority.
Yes, but it's also majority unemployed, or nearly so. Another legacy of the war.
Here we are. They stood in front of the corner fountain at the Gazi Husrev Beg Mosque, which Jack had seen twice before. As usual, people were drinking from the flowing spigot. Along with throngs of tourists shuffling by, there were more traditionally dressed Muslim men and women. One of the women was completely covered, exposing only her wide, dark eyes, which stole a glance at Aida.
I didn't realize there were so many people of fundamentalist faith here, Jack whispered, not wanting to offend.
Those are mostly visitors from Muslim countries. We are becoming quite a tourist destination for them. Jack glanced up at the skyline. The secular buildings in this part of town were 2 or 3 stories at most. But from where he stood, he saw 3 towering minarets. The one here at the fountain, and 2 others,
denoting the locations of other mosques in the area. From what he'd seen so far, Sarajevo appeared to be a secular Western city. But there were so many historically significant Muslim sites in such a close area, Jack could see why people of strong Islamic faith would be drawn here.
So, fundamentalism isn't a big deal in your country? Jack asked.
It's definitely growing, but most Muslims are like me. Islam is more of an expression of our culture and our identity, not a daily religious practice.
Same with a lot of Catholics in America, Jack said, referring to himself. Aida nodded at the streaming fountain water.
The tradition is that if you drink from the fountain, you will someday come back to Sarajevo. And the water is delicious.
Jack took the cue and waited behind a bearded middle-aged man in a skullcap before lapping up a few quick sips of the surprisingly cold and refreshing water. Aida was clearly pleased by the gesture.
Would you like to go inside?
I already stopped in.
Then let's keep going.
They strolled west along the wide paved walkway of Ferhadia that Jack had traversed a couple times before, but Aida pointed out the best shops and places of historical interest, which he had missed entirely. What really intrigued him, though, was the number of smiles and waves and friendly nods that came Aida's way as they walked. It seemed like everybody knew her, including the ones with the obviously forced gestures. If he didn't know any better, he'd have sworn she was the mayor of Sarajevo, or at least this part of it.
Aida pointed out the directional arrows in the pavement stones as they stepped over them, indicating that they were leaving the Turkish side of the city and stepping into the Habsburg side, the part of Sarajevo built during the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The old-world charm of the Ottoman side of the city suddenly gave way to more modern facades of glass and concrete, many of them large foreign banks and chain stores. It felt like they'd passed from one world to another in just a few steps.
The one thing I haven't seen in this city are babies or little kids in strollers.
Well, except for the tourists.
An interesting observation, Jack. You're exactly right. Like the rest of Europe, our demographic profile is collapsing. There's an old saying, where there is no hope, there are no children.
Why isn't there any hope?
Here we are, Aida said. They'd stopped in front of a Swiss chain clothing store.
What am I looking at?
Aida pointed at the plaque on the wall listing the names of 26 people.
All killed by a Serbian artillery shell.
Look. Aida pointed at their feet. The pavement was marred by holes, almost like a flower. A large one in the center, and smaller, irregular ones radiating forward from it. All of the holes were filled with a faded red resin.
That's called the Sarajevo Rose. It marks the spot where the shell exploded, killing people. There are dozens of them all over the city as a kind of memorial.
Jack felt bad. He'd stepped on at least two of these since he'd been here, including this one, not even really noticing. But he saw that the Sarajevans walked over it without noticing either.
A shell from the siege?
Yes. When the city was cut off for over 1,400 days, the longest siege in modern European history. We were starving, thirsty, suffering. And then there were the snipers. And of course, the shelling.
Jack imagined living in a modern American city surrounded and shelled for years. These people must have been overwhelmed with feelings of anger and helplessness.
The war is why there's no hope. The Serbs did more than just kill and wound our bodies.
There must be a lot of resentment toward the Europeans as well for letting it go on for so long.
Yes. We are quite cynical these days about Europe. A bitter past. An uncertain future.
Those memories of the war are still with you, aren't they?
Aida nodded.
Yes, of course. Though I was quite young.
She darkened with a bad memory. Jack waited for her to share more. But she didn't.
We are all Epicureans now, here in Bosnia, she suddenly said with a smile, willing away the darkness. As you can see by the people passing by, we're all smoking and drinking and eating way too much, because today we live, and tomorrow we may die in another mortar attack. The war ended 23 years ago, Jack said. Haven't most people been able to move beyond it? The fighting stopped, yes. But not the war. Not its root causes. Nothing has healed the lingering mistrust and animosity. It's hard to find peace when there is no justice for the nearly 40,000 dead Bosniaks. What do you mean, no justice? Of course, I wouldn't expect you to know our history. But it boils down to this. Almost nobody was prosecuted for war crimes against us, and nobody at NATO or the UN was held accountable for letting the genocidal war go on for years. And when we were finally winning the war against our enemies, despite the NATO arms embargo against us, then NATO threatened to bomb us. So a peace was forced down our throats to protect our enemies. I can understand why Bosniaks are still angry and still dealing with it. Jack wanted to add, but you can't undo the past. Aida searched Jack's eyes. Perhaps you do understand. But you should also know that some of us still have hope. At least a little. She smiled. And where there is hope, there is nothing that cannot be accomplished. She checked her watch, then flashed him another smile. Let me show you why. Moscow. The middle-aged GRU intelligence analyst stared out of the open third-story window of his modest apartment toward Dubky Park, smoking oily Iranian tobacco, grateful the tram wasn't rattling down the middle of the street this cool evening, or worse, bothersome children weren't playing outside. He was waiting for confirmation that an electronic Bitcoin deposit had been made in his account. The Iron Syndicate's digital wanted poster on the dark website he frequented had offered an extremely generous reward for any information that could be provided. Bitcoin was the dark web's preferred currency because of its anonymity, but the analyst insisted on it because he put no faith in the fiat currencies of the world's central banks. He was surprised when his reward was doubled after he provided both the man's stolen image and its geographic metadata to the Iron Syndicate account. That told him the wanted man was indeed wanted badly, and the syndicate was known to pay both well and on time. Still, both his job and his life were hanging in the balance if his treason were to be discovered by his superiors at GRU headquarters. On the other hand, his gambling debts and a drug-addicted girlfriend were significant drains on his meager government salary. To his great delight, the analyst had been the duty officer when the identification request from Sarajevo came in, and he was the one who personally confirmed the identity of Jack Ryan Jr. with a 78% positivity score. If Ryan was wanted by both the Iron Syndicate and the GRU, he was fucked either way. Might as well make a few Bitcoin off the man's corpse while he could, he reasoned, inhaling the last deep draw of bitter smoke from the nub. His computer chimed transfer complete. He grinned and flicked the spent butt into the street below. Time to call his woman and celebrate. Chapter 37. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Aida led the way by foot in a fast 10-minute walk to a cul-de-sac at the end of a nearby side street. A large crowd had already gathered in front of the newly built 3-story building, with a banner in the Bosnian national colors of blue, white, and yellow proclaiming Bosnia Youth Technology and Sports Center. Half of the crowd waved little Bosnian flags, but easily a third waved red Turkish national flags. The Turkish ambassador, Kemal Topal, stood at the top of the entrance steps, flanked by school-aged children and several local politicians. He was just finishing up his speech. Jack turned to Aida, whispering, "He sounds like he's running for office." The ambassador is a remarkable man.
You know him?
Aida just smiled.
Topal laid his hands on the heads of two small children propped beside him. The future of Bosnia stands on either side of me. The 21st century belongs to them, and the 21st century is a technological century. These children will dream technology dreams, and thanks to this center, they will help bring about advances in medicine, robotics, and artificial intelligence, which will change how we live and how we live together. Applause broke out among the crowd, and the kids on the steps, too. But boys and girls need strong bodies as well as strong minds. Life isn't all books, excuse me, tablets and math equations. That is why we are also providing state-of-the-art exercise equipment, as well as martial arts training, dance, and cardiovascular conditioning, what we used to call football. His grandfatherly smile launched another wave of clapping. My government is deeply honored to sponsor the construction and equipping of this magnificent new facility. He turned to the adults around him. And we offer our sincerest congratulations to the mayor, the minister of education, and all of the others who have worked tirelessly to make the dream of the Bosnia Youth Technology and Sports Center a reality for all children in Sarajevo. Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks. Thank you. The Turks in the crowd roared their approval, applauding wildly, and were soon joined by the rest. Topal scanned the audience, noting who was in attendance. His eyes fell on Jack and Aida standing in the back. He whispered in the ear of one of his bodyguards, who nodded and waded into the crowd. Aida turned to Jack. What did you think about the youth center opening?
That was the hope you were talking about.
You have no idea how significant this is. Do you know there are schools in Bosnia where the kids are all separated? One floor is Croat, one floor is Serb, and the third floor is Bosniak, all learning the exact same subjects, but taught separately. They even play in separate yards. What kind of message do you think that sends to those kids?
The Turk bodyguard approached them. Excuse me, but the ambassador would like to speak with the two of you.
Aida and Jack exchanged a look. Jack shrugged.
Sure, why not?
The bodyguard led them back through the chattering crowd, devouring the free snacks and beverages provided by the Turkish embassy, and through the doors of the center and into the foyer. Ambassador Topal dismissed the bodyguard with a friendly nod.
Aida, I'm so glad to see you here, he said, beaming, extending his hand.
Aida shook it.
Congratulations, Your Excellency. This is a wonderful project. I'm so glad it was completed. Ambassador Topal, this is my friend, Jack Ryan.
Topal shook Jack's hand.
Mr. Ryan, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure for me as well.
An American accent. Is it East Coast?
Washington, D.C., perhaps.
Close.
Too close, Jack thought. I live and work in Alexandria, Virginia.
Just across the Potomac.
Topal smiled. I apologize for sounding like the class know-it-all. I was stationed at the Turkish embassy in Washington many years ago. It is a great and historic city.
It was a good posting, despite the summer heat. Tell me, Mr. Ryan, what kind of work do you do?
I'm a financial analyst for the firm Hendley Associates.
Hendley? I once knew a senator by the name of Jerry Hendley.
One and the same. He retired from public life and started the firm.
Technically, Jerry lost his bid for re-election after his emotional collapse following the death of his wife and three children in a car wreck. But Jack didn't feel the need to fill in that tragic detail.
Senator Hendley is a fine man. If you work for him, you must be one as well.
Please tell him I said hello.
I certainly will, sir.
May I ask how you and Ms. Kurich know each other?
Ambassador Topal arranged for the funding of the Peace and Friendship Refugee Center. Without him, My work there wouldn't be possible.
Nonsense, Aida. You were already doing the work. We were proud to partner with you.
Thanks to the ambassador and people like him, Bosnia will have a great future.
Topal turned to Jack.
Aida is a fine administrator, but an even greater soul.
He paused.
So, tell me, Jack, what brought you to Sarajevo?
He stole a glance at Aida before answering.
Sort of what you said about D.C. Sarajevo is a great and historic city, and I always wanted to visit it.
And I see you found the perfect tour guide. She has great reviews on TripAdvisor, for sure.
I use her company for all of my new staff, to orient them to the city, the history, and the culture. There is simply no one better.
You are too kind, Your Excellency, Aida said.
One of Topal's aides signaled for his attention. Topal turned to Jack and Aida.
I'm sure you two have better things to do. I just wanted to say hello.
They shook hands again, but before leaving, Topal said to Jack,
You must stop by my office before you leave.
Thank you. I will.
Please be sure to greet Senator Hindley for me, and let him know about all of the good things you're discovering in this wonderful country.
Yes, sir.
Jack and Aida headed back out onto the street, each even more impressed with the other than they were before.
Hungry? Aida asked.
Sure.
Have you ever had cevapi?
No, but I'm dying to try some.
I know the best place in the city. Let's go. My treat.
Chapter 38. The waitress set a platter of cevapi in front of Jack. The aroma of the sizzling beef sausages and grilled charred bread triggered his inner slavering wolf. Aida ordered a half platter of the same. Not sure how to attack his plate with the available utensils, Jack waited for Aida to demo the long-awaited delicacy. She tore off a piece of flatbread, forked one of the finger-sized sausages onto it, and piled a little mound of finely minced sweet onion on top. Jack followed suit. He thought he might cry for his culinary joy. The grilled minced beef sausages were mildly spiced, the wood-fired bread was smoky and savory, and the raw onions provided a sweet, crunchy heat. The dish was simple, but perfectly combined in its flavors and textures. In his travels around the world, Jack had found that peasant food was usually his favorite. Poor people could never afford the expensive ingredients of haute cuisine, and so had to find a way to coax the maximum amount of flavor out of their simpler fare. This cevapi was the food equivalent of an exquisite Ansel Adams black and white photo.
What do you think? Aida asked between delicate bites.
Jack was working a mouthful of food like a hyena devouring an antelope carcass. He took a swig of Austrian bottled water to wash it down. The restaurant didn't serve alcohol.
Unbelievable. I've heard about this stuff. Had no idea how good it could be.
It's the best cevapi in the city, and believe me, there's a lot of good cevapi in Sarajevo. I'm glad you enjoy it.
The place was packed inside and out. When they arrived, Jack didn't think they'd get to eat. But Aida approached one of the servers, and before she said a word, the server dashed into the back. She emerged with a busboy carrying a small table and two chairs, setting them up outside near the side entrance, where several other customers eagerly consumed their lunches. Jack was halfway through his feeding frenzy when he saw Jerry's phone number appear on his silenced iPhone. A moment later, a voice message alert appeared. Apparently, Jerry had read his text that he wasn't going to be getting on that plane for D.C. today. 10 minutes later, Jack popped the last fragments of bread, onion, and beef into his mouth and polished off his water.
Ready for the rest of the tour? Aida asked.
Can't wait.
The server approached the table, along with a middle-aged man who looked like the owner, greeting Aida with a deferential smile in their native language.
Everything was good? He finally asked Jack in his halting English.
I can't imagine anything better. Incredible.
Aida opened her purse to pay, but the owner waved her off with a magnanimous shrug and words Jack didn't know but completely understood. Aida thanked him, and the two of them headed back to pick up the van at the Happy Times tour office. Aida navigated the crowded street traffic in the Volkswagen T5 tour van like a New York ambulance driver, skillfully weaving and accelerating as conditions required. Jack watched the little arrow on the dashboard GPS screen changing lanes in real time, too. They passed Sarajevo's first of only two McDonald's, and later the presidential building. The buildings on this side of the city were definitely more modern and taller. "I noticed quite a few Turkish flags in the crowd this morning at the youth center," Jack said. "Hundreds of thousands of Turks live in the Balkans, and 12 million people of Balkan origin live in Turkey. Turks are popular here." "It's all a little confusing." "Of course it is," she said with a smile. "It's history." She pointed at a huge multi-story Holiday Inn. "That was built for the 1984 Olympics. You can see pictures of it online when it was burning during the war." "Yeah, I've seen them. Terrible." A little farther along, Aida asked, "Have you heard of Sniper Alley?"
"No."
"We're in it. Google it sometime." She pointed at the surrounding mountains. "Serbian soldiers were up in those hills and in the skyscrapers, shooting at civilians as they ran through town, dodging bullets to find food and water during the siege. Of course, the whole city was a sniper alley. This is just where the journalists got shot at." They left the city center, passing apartment buildings, offices, and light manufacturing facilities. "Ever heard of Srebrenica, Jack?"
"The place where the massacre happened. 8,000 Muslim men and boys slaughtered by the Serbs." "Are we going there now?"
"No. Too depressing. If you want, I can make other arrangements with one of my guides for you. There is also a museum in town dedicated to it, and you can see many documentary videos on YouTube as well." Jack wanted to get to know her better. He knew that the war was important to her understanding of the world and herself. He just wasn't sure how far he could probe. Since his mother was also a part of her story, he hoped she might let him in, at least a little. "Was your family connected to Srebrenica?"
"Every Muslim is connected to it."
"I'm sure. But I mean, did you lose family members there?" Aida shot Jack a sideways glance, keeping one eye on the traffic.
"What the war did to my family is hard for me to talk about."
"Sorry, I didn't mean to—"
"No, it's good to talk about it. Maybe later, okay?"
"Sure.
But today, I want you to understand how the war affected the whole country. If you understand what happened to all of us, then in a way you understand what happened to my family. Does that make sense?"
"Yeah, it does."
"What the Serbs did at Srebrenica is unforgivable. They still won't even admit it happened, which makes it even worse."
"In your mind, is it safe to say that the war and all the things Bosniaks suffered were caused by Serb nationalism?"
"No, not at all. During the war, we were also attacked by the Croats. They're no better than the Serbs."
Aida made a turn off the main road. "The Ustasha were Croatian fascists who cooperated with the Nazis during World War II. Croatia engaged in ethnic cleansing during the Yugoslavian wars, and Bosnian Croats fought us just like the Serbs for a while."
"And now the three of you, Bosniaks, Croats, and Serbs, are trying to live together as a democracy."
"Yes, with Croatia and Serbia as neighboring countries. We've been doing it for over 20 years. I'm just not sure how much longer it can last. There are nationalist forces on all sides agitating for a breakup."
She made another turn onto a small country road.
"I read about a unity referendum coming up soon."
Aida smiled.
"Yes, because there is always hope. Sure, there are many bad Croats and Serbs, but there are also bad Bosniaks, yes? But there are many, many more good people on all sides than bad. We're hoping the referendum will be a big victory over the bad guys who want to start another civil war." Jack watched a Lufthansa regional jet arc low across the windshield on approach to the airport. Will the referendum be enough to prevent it? Aida turned onto an even smaller street crowded with parked cars.
What did Burke say?
All it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. But we have to do something. Or at least try, don't we? Of course. Jack noticed the Sarajevo airport several hundred yards away. And yet, NATO and the EU did nothing to stop the war once it began. Aida found a spot to park and killed the engine. And that's why we're here. Chapter 39. Aida led Jack past the knots of tour groups inside the Sarajevo Tunnel of Hope Museum, pointing out the exhibit of IEDs and landmines planted in the grass, and the display of mortar and artillery shells that hung like wind chimes at the entrance to the tunnel itself. She led him crouching through the short span of timber-framed tunnel and out to the other displays depicting the tragic and heroic efforts of Sarajevans in crisis and under siege. But the main point she wanted to drive home was on the other side of the cyclone fence. She pointed at the airport where Jack had landed a few days before. Sarajevo was completely cut off by the Serbs who occupied the surrounding hills. But here at the airport was where the UN and NATO planes landed with their food supplies, instead of the guns and ammunition we needed to fight. I think I read that the West was worried about the war escalating. They were trying to keep guns out of everybody's hands, not just the Bosniaks. And yet the Serbs and Croats had tanks and planes and all the ammunition they needed to fight, didn't they? Yeah, I guess they did. But at least we had food. She led Jack over to a glass-enclosed display. See? We received American military rations from the Vietnam War. She smiled. Very generous, yes? Jack read the label. 1963. He was embarrassed. Wow. We received powdered chocolate, but no sugar. Flour, but no eggs. My mother used to pick hazelnut leaves off the trees to make dolmas because there weren't any grape leaves. It was a very hard time. And all of it could have been prevented. Her voice trailed off. Jack finished her thought. If only good men had not stood by and done nothing. It would have been a tough call for any NATO government, he thought to himself. Wage war to stop a war? With the Russians next door? It wasn't unreasonable for NATO to try and tamp the fire down first with an arms embargo and hope it went out by itself. Unless, of course, you were a Bosniak living in Sarajevo in 1993. As a student of history, Jack understood NATO's reluctance. But he imagined himself as a Bosniak standing here with a family nearly starving to death in the city behind him. He knew he would be as angry today as Aida obviously was if he had experienced the war the way she and her family had. Tough call. For the umpteenth time, he was glad he would never be president. In 1984, the whole world was cheering the Sarajevo Winter Olympics, Aida said. 10 years later, when it really mattered, who knew we were suffering? After the Tunnel of Hope Museum, Aida drove him to the 17th century Jewish cemetery located on the slope of Mount Trebević. After Spain expelled the Jews in 1492, many of them sought refuge in the Ottoman Empire, and many located here. It's the second largest Jewish cemetery in Europe, with nearly 4,000 headstones and sepulchres. Many of the stones were toppled and damaged. The war was here too, wasn't it? Yes. We fight even among the dead. Unexploded mines and bombs weren't removed until years after the war. It's safe now. Safe, but neglected, judging by the graffiti on some of the stonework and the trash in the grass. Aida then drove Jack to a high point in the pine-covered mountains overlooking the city, a sea of red-tiled roofs in the sprawling valley down below. She pointed out the Serb positions, and from here Jack could clearly see the advantage their guns would have had over the terrified civilians below. She next took him to the nearby abandoned Olympic bobsled track, now a graffiti artist's wet dream of tubular concrete and colorful spray paint surrounded by tall evergreens. It was actually quite beautiful in its own unique post-apocalyptic anarchism. He ignored the Fuck Ryan USA splattered in red spray paint on one of the support columns, though it couldn't be missed. Aida was courteous enough not to point it out, even though she surely saw it. He wondered what her reaction would be if she knew how closely connected he was to the slanderous jab. Jack would have liked to meet the poet laureate while he was rendering his aerosolized thoughts, to offer him a few choice adjectives of his own as he lifted the lad into an ambulance. Aida pointed out the bullet and shrapnel scars on the bobsled run. Our forces used these heavy concrete tubes as elevated bunkers. Such a waste. Yes. But by then, what else were they good for? How do you get beyond all of this? Jack asked as Aida drove them to their next destination. Even if every war criminal went to jail and every politician apologized, it wouldn't bring back the tens of thousands of people killed. You're right. If we only look to the past, we can never move forward as a nation. But because we still haven't dealt with the real causes of the war, I'm afraid we're doomed to repeat the same mistakes. I thought you had hope. I do. There is a bright future for my country. I'm just not exactly sure how we get there. They rode along for a minute, when Aida suddenly popped Jack on the arm with a friendly tap, trying to change the somber mood. Enough of all of this depressing war talk. Let me show you why my city is the most beautiful in the world, and why it will be great again. They spent the rest of the day taking in the best Sarajevo had to offer, indoors and out. They wound up back in the old town, browsing through the shops of Aida's favorite local artists. As they passed one of the shops, Jack saw a phrase stenciled in black block letters on the wall. It seemed completely out of place, and yet the owner didn't remove it. Samo nek ne puca. Jack pointed it out. What does it mean? Aida grinned. You have to understand our dark humor. It's a saying that came out of the war, but it applies today. You know, with the high unemployment and corruption, all of our other troubles. The joke translates to something like, our lives totally suck and aren't worth living, but at least nobody is shooting at us. She led Jack into a small gallery of handmade jewelry and art. She picked out a pair of handmade bronze earrings crafted from thin strips of antique coffee urns, etched with designs and studded with two small stones. The woman placed them in a small, cleverly folded box of her own design and handed it to Jack. What's this?
For your mother, Aida said. My gift to her.
She'll love these.
I know she will.
Aida smiled.
I have excellent taste.
She reached into her purse. But the gallery owner refused to take her money despite her repeated attempts. Aida finally relented, and they headed out. They ended the afternoon at Baklava Duchan, run by a couple young guys with a passion for culinary tradition. The best in town, Aida assured Jack, as they were served coffee and the Bosnian version of baklava. The Greek, or was it Turkish, dessert was usually a cloying, honey-soaked stack of crunchy phyllo, but the pieces he tried here had far more subtle flavors and a softer texture that practically melted in his mouth. He predicted a world of hurt for himself when he finally got back to early morning PT in Alexandria after this bout of sweet indulgence. But it was so worth it. Aida never once mentioned anything personal about the war again after the bobsled run, though it was never far from Jack's mind, and there was a sadness descending on both of them, knowing that the day was nearly over. He hated the idea of leaving Sarajevo, in part because Aida's love for it had now taken hold of him as well. But he hated the idea of leaving her even more. Still, he had a job to do back home, and his goal of finding her and delivering his mother's letter had been completed. Two more unplayed voicemails from Jerry told Jack it was time to push on. They finished their coffee and baklava, but this time Jack insisted on paying the bill.